I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. Online education, or distance learning, is a $3 billion industry in the U.S. right now, and it's getting bigger all the time. More than 1.5 million students are getting some part of their higher education online. And with enrollments growing, along with profit margins, some are predicting that college classrooms and cake parties will soon go the way of the horse and buggy. Oh, well, that may be an exaggeration, but you get the point. But the online education story took a new twist last week when the Massachusetts Institute of Technology announced it's putting all its courses online for free. MIT's announcement is drawing praise from the higher educational community and stirring fear in the online education industry. To some, MIT's announcement is a bold move, wresting the internet back from the money-grubbing hands of the dot-commers, reaffirming its original promise to make information free and available to all. Connection listeners, are you ready to log on, put a college degree in your online shopping basket? Do you think that e-education is the way of the future, or just a high-tech throwback to the correspondence courses of yesteryear? We're exploring the wonderful world of e-education this hour. We want you to join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK are the numbers to call to join in. Or you can email us. Seems appropriate in this hour, certainly. Online, we're at www.theconnectionallonword.org. I'm joined in the studio by Greg Jarboe, Vice President of Marketing at WebCT, a company that is the leading creator of e-learning systems for higher education, based in Lynnfield, Massachusetts, and also by Dick Yu, Associate Dean of Engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and the guy who sort of brought out this change of pace, this curveball into the whole e-education mix. Welcome to you both. Dick Yu, could you tell us, in 3 minutes or less, how MIT decided to put its coursework online for free?
The idea of open courseware at MIT, or MIT's open courseware, came from the deliberations of a study group that formulated the idea and proposed it to MIT last year. I happen to have chaired the study group, and subsequent to that, we had a lot of meetings and dialogue and conversations and fora within MIT, and I was also a part of a team that participated in that. And that led up to the announcement of OpenCourseWare last week.
Right. Was it hard to convince the faculty to do this, to put this out there to such a wide audience?
In my almost 30 years at MIT, including my student days, I've never seen anything done by MIT at sort of internet speed, and I've never seen quite something roll out with that many conversations being held at the same time and so forth. We've had a lot of faculty input, some of it extremely positive, some concerns, others guarded optimism, as you might expect out of a very diverse faculty that we have.
Greg Jarboe, when you heard about MIT's decision, what did you think?
Well, I read it in the New York Times last week, and I thought it was a brilliant move. I was very impressed.
How will that affect your business, though?
Not at all. It doesn't impact our business any more than someone donating books to a library impacts the bookstore sales down the street. And I think both have coexisted on a campus for a long time. There is a absolutely perfect place for things that are free, and there also is a very appropriate place for things that are for sale. And the interesting thing that I think the media has distorted what MIT did is that somehow or other they were giving away education for free. And MIT is still charging tuition. Faculty members are still being paid salaries.
Knowledge for free, though.
Yes. Some things on the web. We have a website where we offer certain services for free, and we also have a business where we sell an application to colleges and universities.
Who want to be online and offer coursework online for a fee?
Correct. Right.
How many colleges are you working with at the moment?
WebCT has over 1,700 colleges and universities in 67 countries using our application to put courses online. We have over 300.
How does that work? I mean, when you say courses online, what does that look like when you sit at home?
It can look different ways for different courses, but it can be as little as a syllabus online. If a faculty member, that's all they want to do, that they can
just a syllabus.
Yeah, it can be that simple. So the students at the beginning of the course can go find out what they need to do to take the course. At the other end of the spectrum, WebCT enables faculty to create a course that can be used in distance learning, where the student never sees the faculty member at all. They take all their tests online. They interact with the faculty through bulletin boards online. Everything is done virtually.
Dick, how do you envision MIT's course material? How will it appear if I choose to try and understand it online?
I think what OpenCourseWare would look like, it will be there will be a portal whereby it will be open to the world and people could come and see, for example, what we are doing in an undergraduate program or graduate program.
See what you are doing, but I mean, if you're offering coursework, I mean, are you going to offer whole lectures?
Yeah, I think OpenCourseWare would include things like course syllabus, outline, lecture notes, assignments, exams, reading
right.
lists, what
an
have you.
An assignment or an exam. Now, this is getting to the point, which is I'm sitting at home, and for whatever reason, I'm not accepted at MIT. I'm not wealthy enough to take one of Greg Jarboe's online courses through a university, but I'm hungry for knowledge. And I sit down. Knowledge is absorption, but it's also demonstration that you actually understand what you've taken in. Where does that interaction of education take place online if, one, you aren't paying a fee to a course as you would through one of Greg Jarboe's colleges, or with MIT, which is offering the material out there, which is great, but, I mean, suppose I write the essay, can I email it back to Professor whomever and expect a comment?
Right. One of the things that OpenCourseWare is not is that it is not a distance education initiative. MIT is not trying to extend an education to that person. MIT, however, is providing the material, the core material that that person might want to use or educators elsewhere might want to use to educate people around them. MIT, this is not a distance education initiative in that sense.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, wasn't MIT trying to figure out how to do precisely that?
Well, MIT actually has activities in the so-called distance education field, both in terms of offering material to customized material, if you may, to certain people. And also MIT has educational programs that involve an online component as well. But OpenCourseWare is not about these things.
Yeah, MIT, for example, could choose to purchase WebCT and use it in their online courses. So this is not a mutually exclusive thing.
In fact, you would probably urge MIT to purchase WebCT, and you're exchanging business cards after the hour is over.
I think it would be a brilliant move on MIT's part. The confusion here is, where does education take place? And I think the brilliant thing that MIT has done is recognize that the educational content, the educational value, is something that happens in the class. It's the interaction between the faculty and the students. Now, the web can enhance that. The web can enable students to interact with faculty in ways that you can't do face-to-face in a class. But the interaction between faculty and students, or students and students, is the learning. The things that are there, the syllabus, the lecture notes, are aids. But they're more, no more should be confused with education than, let's say, a used textbook. You know, and I may pick up a used textbook and read it and think I've gotten a education, but, you know, it was useful. But that I wouldn't confuse that with something for credit.
We're talking about online education, university education, let's be clear. In this hour, Connection listeners, we're talking about, is this simply another business extension of universities who have long since moved beyond the ivory tower image that those of us who grew up in the 50s and 60s had of colleges? We know their businesses. Is this just an extension of business? Or is this a return possibly to the original promise of the Internet, that it's a place where information is shared and people who are curious can find things out? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. David is calling from Louisville. Duncan is calling from Providence, Rhode Island.
I'm a graduate student. I've been a teaching assistant. I have
taught part-time, so I'm speaking from that perspective. I guess I would open by saying I think that this scheme is sort of the Napster of the university. And I think it has the potential of doing harm to the careers of professors and those who are creating ideas, because creating new knowledge is the bread and butter of our livelihoods. It's, it's what we get tenure with and so forth. And it seems like distributing this information free on the internet is in a way, it means that any time we teach a course, any time we have ideas which may be very unfinished, may be very much in progress, may be something we intend to work on with the students, that we in effect have to publish them and perhaps turn the rights over to the university or to whoever is in charge of the web scheme.
Dick, you are the associate dean at MIT, and I did ask you before, wasn't this difficult? Now I'm going to let Duncan ask again. I mean, how did you convince faculty to give this up?
I think first we have to be very clear that OpenCourseWare, as MIT envisages it, involves voluntary participation by faculty. This is not MIT dictating that everybody has to publish it. In addition to that, faculty retains control over the material that they do put on OpenCourseWare. If you may, they retain the copyright to it. They are just giving permission for MIT to do that. So there isn't this issue of being forced to do that. Having said that, though, I think MIT is very much operating on its core mission to be creation and dissemination of knowledge. We have a tradition of developing these things, giving it out in the form of textbooks, if you may, or even we've developed software like for Windows or X Windows and other things that we've given away for free.
Duncan, you're a graduate student. I mean, you're working on a thesis at the moment.
That's right, a dissertation.
A dissertation in what subject?
In music.
In music. Well, that's a particular subject. I mean, presumably you're writing music?
No, musicology.
Musicology. But are you saying that you would be loath, if you were teaching a course as a graduate student, to have your original material before you've had a chance to publish it as a book out there in this fashion?
Yes. Well, to give one example, because I'm doing a fieldwork study, and I've taken a class on field methods. And the professor had, in the course of teaching this class, had offered us a good deal of material that he had created in the course of his own studies, but it was the kind of thing that could not be published, that could not be generally disseminated, that was really only for the eyes of a few of his students there. And that kind of material obviously cannot be put onto the web.
I just want to quickly cut in and say that MIT, say 50 years ago, MIT went about publishing a lot of their course material in books. And some of it is also taken by its own graduates into other universities and so forth. I think it's very much in the spirit of higher education for people to share, to exchange, and to improve what we do. It's not certainly you can publish it in addition to that and or otherwise, but it's not an exclusive thing.
Duncan, I want to thank you for your call. We'll pick this point up after the break, and we have phone lines and a few more guests. We're talking about online education. Is it the best use of the net? Is it the promise of the net? Or is it simply extending the business profile of universities? This is The Connection from National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBU.
I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is the Online Education Connection. My guests in the studio are Professor Dick Yu, Associate Dean of Engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which has just announced it will be putting its course material online free of charge. Whether you can understand it or not is a different question. And Greg Jarbo, Vice President of Marketing at WebCT, which creates web applications for people who sell education online. And I'm joined on the line now from Phoenix by Brian Mueller, Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the University of Phoenix, which has the largest online learning program in the U.S., and also from Washington, D.C., by Carol Fungaroli Sargent, Professor of English at Georgetown University and author of the book Traditional Degrees for Non-Traditional Students. Welcome to you both. Brian Mueller, how many students at the University of Phoenix are getting their degrees online?
Well, the University of Phoenix, as a university, has about 90,000 students spread throughout the world. About 22,000 of those, just under 22,000 of those, are attending and earning their degrees completely in an online format.
And do you charge as much for an online degree as a traditional degree?
Well, what's interesting is that we charge just a little bit more.
And why is that?
Well, we're in the beginning of a new industry, and actually, it's new for a lot of people. We've been doing it since 1989. But what we realize is that what we think is that you've got to make significant investments to do a quality job. And the reason our program is growing so quickly, we think, is because we've built some elements into this that are expensive elements that, that bring quality to it. For example? Well, a number of things. You've got to put significant dollars into your technical infrastructure. Your system has to be available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's got to be up all the time, 99.9% of the time. It has to be easily accessible from anywhere in the world. To support 22,000 students, that's a significant investment. Secondly, you've got to put significant dollars into faculty training. A lot of people, we think, miss that element. We have about 1,800 faculty members, again, those people being spread throughout the world. They have to go through a very intensive 10-week training process, regardless of what academic credentials they have or what work experience they've had, because there's a significant difference between teaching online and teaching physically in the classroom.
But that is the question. I mean, you're teaching online. I mean, you stream video of lectures. You have interesting visual effects, or is it just text online?
Well, that's another very interesting topic. What are you going to create, from a university perspective, a media-driven program, or are you going to create a faculty-driven and student-driven program? It's an interesting decision universities have to make. We have decided that we're not doing anything different in our online programmatic offerings than really what we do in our physical classroom.
No, I understand that. But so what I'm asking you is, do you video lectures and then stream it down the web so that essentially, you know, it's like if someone, you know, was a shut-in at home and couldn't get to class, they could watch video? Or is there something that's uniquely web-based in the way the information is discussed?
But for the most part, things are delivered from a lecture standpoint, from an information standpoint, content standpoint, via text.
Via text. So you haven't taken that step beyond to saying, well, we have to figure a new way to tell our story, our education information, in a way that works coming out of a computer screen.
No, and the reason, and there will be media elements, and there are media elements that are being that we're putting into the curriculum. But the point is that only where those things add to the efficiency of student learning will we put them in. If you look at what we do from an online perspective and why it's successful, is because the academic model is very true to the academic model that exists in a successful classroom.
Greg Jarbo.
Yes, WebCT's research indicates the same kind of thing, that online learning is not a passive, I'm going to sit back and watch video streaming like I might watch television. The killer application on the web is the interactivity that it allows between faculty and students and student and students. So something as simple as a bulletin board that allows for an asynchronous question to get posted and then someone to respond and other people to join in or comment on is something that the web enables that you would love to see in a classroom discussion. But what the web allows is someone to come back, let's say, 4 hours later and actually see that discussion on the web that you can't duplicate if you missed the class.
Carol Sargent, your book is called Traditional Degrees for Non-Traditional Students, and you've interviewed a lot of kids who have tried the online option. What do you think of this?
They're bored stiff, and I don't blame them. And by the way, I want to congratulate MIT for charging exactly what online courses are worth, and that is zero. I think that what's wonderful about what MIT has done is that they've thrown the technology open. They've said, come have a look. But they're charging exactly what someone's going to get out of it, which is about as much as they're going to get out of reading a book or, you know, doing anything else just without having any interaction with a professor or having any interaction with a class.
Brian Mueller?
So,
yes.
I'm sure you have something to say back to that.
Yes. If you create an online program correctly, if you create the right kind of electronic classroom, what you can do is create a an environment where students actually have more interaction with their fellow students, more interaction with their faculty member than typically they get in a traditional classroom.
Well, then why hasn't the University of Phoenix done it? The product is so colossally boring, unimaginative, and expensive. People just look at this stuff. It's terrible.
Well,
and you admit that it costs more. You admit that you're making money on the back of the first students, serving them a substandard product. And I think it's time
I'm glad that you're speaking your mind with great frankness.
Yes,
we try and maintain a level of discourse that is
okay.
Slightly less inflammatory between participants. Brian, or Greg, because you're both involved in the business. Calmly, could you just respond to Carol's suggestion that it is actually boring and doesn't entice the student in the way that being present in the classroom does?
Actually, yes, I'd love to respond to that. The exactly opposite is true. And again, you've got to have some experience in creating this environment, which we do. Our retention rate for our students who start the program is over 70%. When you keep the group small, when you create a highly interactive environment that is very social, and our environment is very social, what you can do is actively engage our students, who are working adult students, in a way that is equally as stimulating in an online environment as you can in a classroom environment. That doesn't mean the online environment is for everybody, because certainly it's not. But to say that you can't create a very intellectually stimulating environment in that format couldn't be further from the truth. And the fact that we're growing as fast as we are in this program and that the retention rate is as high as it is really evidence of the fact that that's true.
800-422
Carol,
you say it doesn't prove anything.
Yeah.
First of all, are there this is so new. There have been no accurate longitudinal studies because there's not been around longitudinally enough.
Au contraire.
Really?
Au contraire. There have been studies that have been done over the last several years and longitudinally. WebCT has been used since the fall of 97. There are a number of institutions who have actually addressed this very issue. And what I would say is that both Brian and Carol are half right, and that's why this is a fun debate. What we've discovered is that there are some students that respond better online, there are other students that respond better in class, and that if you compare online to in class, you get what is called the no significant difference phenomena. It's about the same. You can have a boring lecture, you can have a boring online class. You can have an exciting lecture, you can have an exciting online class. The big win educationally is when you offer a mix of both, because what you find is you can engage different students using different methods. Some students who feel very comfortable raising their hand in class and participating in class discussion. Other students feel more comfortable participating in an online conversation for a variety of reasons. And if you have both in your class, if you're using both face-to-face and web-based instruction, you're able to engage a broader percentage of the kids in your class, and that's where learning occurs.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Ray is on the line.
This has been fun listening to this.
It's going to get more fun, trust me. If I get an open mic, I'm going to go for it.
I started off calling because of something that Greg said, and I think he misstated his position, having listened to what he's just said more recently about learning taking place between the professor and the student. He added face-to-face as an essential component. And we've been doing online education at the Concord Consortium now for well over 7 years. So we've got a lot of experience with it. And just a couple of points. Somebody said just a little bit, online education is not for everybody. I agree with that point. There's a corollary that was missed. Face-to-face education is not for everybody. We have lots of evidence that not everybody who goes into a face-to-face education program succeeds. One of the things that's been going on in the debate is that there's an assumption that face-to-face is best and online is consistently second best. That's not the case. That's not the experience if you have a good online course. And the comparison is if you have somebody sitting in the back using the higher ed model, sitting in the back of a 500-person lecture hall, do you consider that good face-to-face education.
Ah, but Carol teaches at Georgetown, and your classes presumably are slightly smaller.
Not only are they smaller, but I teach my readers not to go to the 500-person class. I teach them how to shop for the in-person personal experience, which I think is very important. When they read traditional degrees, they don't just learn how to get a degree. They learn how to educate themselves. And part of that is shopping better and not taking substandard options, which I lump distance learning, but I also lump the 500-person class. Yep. I think it's time we got rid of that while we're at it.
What, the 500-person class?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, well obviously, and I was assuming that at Georgetown, surely that your class sizes can't be larger than 25.
Yes, but you know, one interesting thing to show is that I didn't start at Georgetown. I was an adult returning student. I was 28 years old. I was a full-time legal secretary, and I started at George Mason University out in Fairfax at night. I was one of the students that this product purports to serve, and what infuriates me is that this product will never give its students the same power and the same skills and the same academic credentials that I developed that got me to Georgetown in the first place. How did I get from a secretary's desk to a professor's desk? Well, it sure as heck wasn't by taking a fifth-rate online option. You know, it's funny, you were talking
about... Let me just interrupt there and say, is it the online option, or is it the fact that you don't think that the quality out there is good?
Well, it's very low, but it's also, it is the distance as well. I mean, even if it were an excellent product, and let's say it was, you know, why don't I go ahead and grant that, and let's say we're dealing with an excellent product. I say that your education is like sex on the internet. You can get it online, but it's a lot better in person. If someone tells you, oh, well, you know, I indulged in internet sex or something like that, I mean, you might think that they're human, but if someone told you that that was their only outlet for having
Carol,
a relationship,
Carol,
I think you'd be
Carol.
Utterly shocked.
I'm amazed that you would consider education requires physical contact. I went to three different institutions of higher education, University of Michigan, University of Edinburgh, and Scotland, and Lesley College, and I don't recall touching anybody in class ever.
So, me either.
So if education is supposed to be engaging your mind, there are different ways to engage your mind. You can do it reading a book. And that's why there are textbooks associated with courses. You can do it listening to a lecture or talking in class. That's face-to-face works, too. The fact that the Internet allows you to do some other things interactively that the medium excels at over other media is one that educators ought to harness if they really are interested in teaching and learning.
Well, then how come when I go to WebCT or I go to the University of Phoenix and I look around for, you know, give me one name. Give me one person with some credentials here.
Okay, hold on a second. Okay, Brian?
Yes.
This is your turn to talk about your program.
Let me respond to that, yeah, because I could tell you all the great things about the University of Phoenix Online program, and obviously I have a vested interest in doing that. However, the 60 Minutes did a pretty significant amount of research and 3 or 4 weeks ago, and Arthur Levine, who's president of Columbia Teachers College, was a principal in that show, and he came on and said, you know, the University of Phoenix online program is growing rapidly, and I went down to do a very thorough investigation of that program, hoping to find a lack of quality. In fact, the word he used was hoping to find a diploma mill. What he said at the end of the program was, what I in fact found was very, very high quality education.
Brian, when you're marketing, and that's actually the right word, I think, the University of Phoenix online programs. What is it that you're telling the students who paid it to learn online? What is it that you're offering them at the end? You're offering them a bachelor's degree, but are you also offering them a credential that will have value to them if their purpose in higher education is to get the credential to get the job?
Well, what we're saying to them is that if they start this program, if they do this program, they're going to be involved in a very rigorous, very difficult academic experience that will lead to the degree that they're seeking if they stay with it. And that it's a University of Phoenix degree. It doesn't matter whether you attend class online or whether you attend class in the classroom.
What it matters to corporate recruiters.
If I can just finish that, most of our students will say that if they have experienced both modalities, and the point made earlier by the gentleman from WebCT was very good, to say that online education is good or bad or that classroom-based education is good or bad is not the point. The point is, what is the quality of the course that's being offered? How good is the curriculum? How good is the instructor? How well-trained is the instructor? Those are the things that matter. And most of our students who have taken courses in both modalities will say, without question, the experience they had in online is more rigorous. It's more difficult. When you are involved with fellow students and instructor in a very interactive, very collaborative intellectual experience, and you've got to put in writing your thoughts every single day, both in the form of papers, in the form of case study, in the form of open debate, 24/7, and all that's part of a permanent archive for people to go back and take a look at. That's a very rigorous academic intellectual experience, and in most people would say even more rigorous and intellectual than what happens in a typical classroom, where frequently three or four people dominate the conversation and the rest of the people are very passive.
And I can think, yes, and some people are dominating the conversation at the moment. I need to bring in Dick Yu.
Yeah.
Dick Yu, thank you.
I just want to add quickly I'm listening with great amusement to this debate going on. Obviously, we have a lot more to learn about educational pedagogy in the internet age, if you may. I just want to add that at MIT, we are actually heavily into using IT to enhance our education. There are dedicated groups looking at very innovative ways to teach and so forth. And of course, we have to emphasize that MIT's value to the student is not more than just those IT products, if you may. The peer learning, the faculty interactions, the hands-on, and so on and so forth. And unfortunately, of course, MIT could not open its doors to more than some thousands of people at one time. And so this debate, I think, is extremely relevant to education.
And you know why it couldn't open its doors? Because MIT has standards, and you have to meet the standards to get in. Students who are getting these diluted degrees aren't even, I mean...
Carol, I'm going to interrupt you because you're coming back after the break, but okay. Brian Mueller is going to be leaving us. So, Brian, a final word to you.
I think the debate has been good. I applaud what MIT has done. I think any time that we take information and make it accessible to people, that's a good thing. However, I think they've also been very correct in stating that education is a lot more than that. You've got to gather people together around a very structured curriculum. They've got to produce work. They've got to have a lot of interaction.
Brian Mueller, thank you very much for joining us. Brian Mueller, Vice President of the University of Phoenix. This is The Connection from National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WB.
I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is the Online Education Connection. We're talking about learning online. MIT has just announced it's going to post its course material on the web, free. You can access it, learn what you can. You don't get a degree. There are other online universities where you certainly do pay and you do get a degree. Where's the difference? What are the advantages? And because we're having an online discussion, I just have to read a couple of postings from the Connection website. If you can't get to a phone and you want to join in the conversation online, you can contact us at www.theconnectionalloneword.org. Jeannie posts this message. Community is lost. We were talking about, can you learn outside of the, if you're not part of a community of students and teachers? And she asks rhetorically, have you participated in an online course? ! The building of community is incredible in an online course. Thank you, Jeannie, for that thought. And let me throw that to Carol Fungaroli-Sargent, who's the professor of English at Georgetown University, author of the book Traditional Degrees for Non-Traditional Students.
I have now, actually. It's been my honor to have been invited into a number of online classrooms. And, you know, I'm going to grant them this. And what I'm going to grant is that there is something that goes on between the students in a lot of these situations. Unfortunately, students can't give each other credit for going to college. And I'm looking back again at the adult who needs a bachelor's degree, who needs that first bachelor's degree. They're participating in programs that have the liberal arts stripped out, that are low prestige.
But in truth, yeah. Carol, I mean, yeah. As the sheer size of higher mm-hmm. education in this country has developed over the last three decades, mm-hmm. many adults, and your own particular case is very interesting, many people who do not, you know, come from a background that allows them to enter university at the age of 18, carry on for 4 years and just do the typical thing, but who claw their way back towards higher education after working for time, enter courses that, let's be honest, long before the net was invented, many adult education, returning education courses, bachelor's degree courses did not provide the full range. They were people who entered them wanted were going to higher education because they wanted the credential.
What didn't they provide? That was, you know, that's kind of funny because when I went back to college, when I went back at 28, I thought that I was going back into a world where I didn't belong. I blew the top off the grading scale, and believe me, I had flunked out of college the first time.
What I'm talking about in terms of provisions is we're talking about, you know, I think that, and perhaps Greg Jarboe or Dick, you can add in on this. A lot of, you know, extension courses, adult education courses, yes, people go all the way through, but you know as well that it isn't the full...
Right.
Well, they're garbage. I say go on campus. Go get the real thing. Do you know adult students are the best students on campus? They're the ones who are getting the A's.
That's a different discussion.
Carol, you're talking basically about a one-size-fits-all approach to education. There are different students in different circumstances. No. There are different students in different circumstances.
Uh-huh.
I'll take a case of Marshall University down in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
The average student who takes the online course down there lives 40 miles away from campus. And if I want to get my master's degree, I have to drive 40 miles every night after work, after feeding the kids dinner or whatever. It would put a lot of those students at risk. And they were evaluated, they were surveyed, and when they were asked, is this as good as face-to-face? They said yes. They were also asked, by the way, are there any ways we could improve this online course? And they said, yeah, we'd like to meet face-to-face maybe once at the beginning of the class and once at the end just to see each other because we've met each other online. But that wasn't necessary for the, quote, course itself. So there is a value in face-to-face, but it doesn't...
But who's teaching this stuff? Well, that's what, and really
full faculty, from the graduate school.
Then
Carol, this is the other participants in the conversation are the callers, and we need to get, we have a lot of calls. I want to get some of them on the air. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Len is on the line. Line one.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I mean, this discussion has moved a long way since its beginning when we were talking about, I think, bare bones information being provided by MIT. And I think that, by the way, that the offering that they're making and calling it courseware is a little bit of a misnomer. I don't think it's courseware till it's worked up to the standards of the web environment and optimized for that type of learning, as I guess Greg's company is doing. But I wanted just to make two comments, one of which is that I think this internet-based education is here to stay, and despite Carol's opinion of its quality, at present, it does make education accessible to a lot of people who are either geographically or financially prevented from getting it in some other fashion. And I think that's an important value that's not being emphasized enough. Without that, the opportunity for distance learning, there are a lot of people who wouldn't have any options and any opportunity. Not everybody can go to a in-person college environment.
Let me ask you, do you think that there's a difference between education, knowledge, and information?
That was the second point I was going to make, is that it really does have to be learning. And learning is based on the model of education, adding value to information. The dean at MIT, whose name I forgot, but
it's Dick Yu, and he's sitting right here.
Dick, you mentioned that there is some sort of committee that is studying how to develop and I guess optimize the course material for an online environment. And it seems to me that MIT should wait until it has some of those answers to provide real learning.
Dick, are you considering waiting?
Len, let me first address some earlier points you made. Indeed, OpenCourseWare may not be the best term. Possibly open course content. We struggle with the name, but the name aside, Barebone, you also mentioned in that first part of your conversation. Barebone depends on who you're referring to. I mean, think to people who have access to very sophisticated material. It could be Barebone, but to a large fraction of people in this country, and perhaps even definitely also worldwide, what we might be putting on could be a lot more than what they could be expected to be able to get their hands on. And so I don't think we should immediately suggest that just because it does not have interactive components and so forth, its value is therefore so significantly limited for those people.
Dick, what is the profile of your user, your customer? Is this an already educated person who would know how to take that material and make use of it? It seems there are different, I guess, target markets or audiences for online education.
Well, not really a market, presumably, with Dick, because, I mean, the information is just going to be posted, right?
Right.
The question is a good one, and Greg perhaps also might want to join in on this. Who is the target market? And carry on, Len. Len?
Yes, I'm still here. I'm wondering who you envision to be using this information when a course is offered that is actually worked up to the point of being, I guess, web optimized, that it's real courseware where there's some learning going on. Then you can market that to people who are ready to learn that skill or to have that insight, whatever it may be. But if you're just providing a course syllabus and reading materials and so forth, well, they can get most of that at a library, and who do you imagine to be using that information that MIT is going to post?
Right, and let me just respond to that. It's not just course syllabus and outline and the like. It's also lecture notes. It's also an ability for someone to look into MIT, as it were, through a window to see the MIT education across the board. So they could not look at one particular subject, but to look at the education. What does a student do the first year, second year? What does a graduate curriculum in a certain field be looking like? And so on and so forth. But I think the point has to be made that it's that, well, we don't talk about customers. I think Michael was correct to point out. In terms of audience, we have in mind all the way from our colleagues in other universities who might want to interact with us and improve mutually our enterprise in education. It could be a high school teacher or very precocious, even a high school senior wanting to look at some of our freshman courses and see what it's like, for example.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Kathleen is on the line.
Yes. I've been working in this field for actually almost 20 years now, and designing courses and working with both Harvard and MIT for the last, really since the birth of the Internet. And I have two comments that I think will help frame the discussion a little more. One is that we've discovered that the locus of value is really proximity to the faculty. So the closer you are to the professor, really the more you should pay, and the further out you get, the less you should pay and the less value you derive from the course. And that's an important point that addresses the concerns, I think, of everyone who's spoken so far. The second issue is that what you're doing when you go online is moving the context of the learning to essentially a big database. And once you do that, you do have the opportunity to do some things that you can't do in the classroom. So one of the things we do, for example, is we poll the students online about their attitudes about things. And in one of the courses we're developing, we actually ask them, do they prefer SUVs or minivans in terms of their driving preferences?
And what did you learn from this?
And well, what we learn is that we can later correlate that data with decisions that they have to make. So, for example, in a case study, we ask people, would you fire this person? And it turns out that the SUV drivers are more likely to fire this person than the minivan drivers. But she turns out to be CEO material later on. Okay? Now, that's a learning moment
that
you can't get in the class.
We've all just learned something quite remarkable, and I'm an SUV guy, I'm afraid. Go ahead.
One of the things I want to pick up on that is the closeness to the professor. We've been conducting over the last 2 years what we call an exemplary course project, where we try to identify those online courses that really, really, on the basis of academic rigor and content robustness, break through and need to be celebrated. And the closeness to the professor is a key element, but you can do that online. And so if you're a student, we'll go back to the proverbial 500 student class, and you get to talk to your professor two or three times a semester, that's maybe physical proximity, but it's not feeling that you really interacted with that professor. Or if the closest you get to face-to-face teaching is a teaching assistant, you know, yeah, that's a benefit too. But if the faculty actually responds to your question online, what we find is the magic moment for students is the professor answered my question. He responded to me, and they feel they come out of that online experience closer to the professor than if they were in the same room.
I'm utterly baffled. I want to know, what planet are you on where the professors don't respond to student questions? I receive email from my students. I interact with them personally.
Well,
all of my professors when I was an undergraduate did
Professor
the same.
Carol.
Fungaroli Sergeant,
yes,
of
indeed.
Georgetown.
Well, of Georgetown University.
But what we're
curious to know is, I mean, we're talking about class size and proximity, and I think that, you know, Greg makes an interesting point that in the huge classes. Now, what is the largest class size that you have? Carol.
Me, personally?
Yes.
What is the 35 students.
35
and I advise my students not to take anything larger.
Yes, I would advise my students that, too. But if I was attending a huge state university, I might not have that option.
I have attended huge state universities.
I know you have, but I'm saying...
Shop carefully. And also, you know, let's go back. There was the caller earlier said the students who don't have the time or the money to go back in person. In-person education is cheap. You can get at a great state university, you can get an in-person education for about $20,000, which is less than the price of a mid-sized car. That's a bargain. And online, Brian Mueller admits from University of Phoenix.
Okay, Brian Mueller has gone out, and we're actually coming to the end of the hour, and I want to thank you for taking part, Carol Sergeant at Georgetown University in Washington. But I'd just like to ask Dick Hugh for a final comment. How soon will the MIT material actually be up?
We are entering a first phase where we're thinking in terms of putting up about 500 courses in the next year and a half, almost 2 years.
How big's the server?
we're not very worried about that.
You've annexed all of Cambridgeport. Is that the truth?
No, actually, in terms of cost, I think the cost to host these and serve them are actually relatively small compared to the cost of people time to make this happen.
Greg Jarboe, just one final thought from you about whether this form of learning will, like so many other promised business opportunities on the web, succeed over the next 5 years, or will it go the way of fads?
E-learning is the next big killer application on the internet. That's not me talking. That's what John Chambers of Cisco has said, and I think he's right.
This is The Connection. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We've been talking with Dick Hewitt, Dean of Engineering, Professor at MIT, and Greg Jarboe, Vice President of Marketing at WebCT. Graham Smith is our senior producer. This is The Connection from NPR.
This is WBUR.